In this episode, we are going to be talking about the classic Western Johnny Guitar from 1954, which starred Joan Crawford, Sterling Hayden, Mercedes McCambridge. It was directed by Nicholas Ray and from a screenplay by Philip Yordan. My guest today, I want to welcome back Toby Roan, who wrote this fantastic book, which you'll see behind me here, on the making of The One-Eyed Jacks, A Million Feet of Film, which was Marlon Brando's solo directing effort, which he also starred in. It's a fascinating book that he came on back in June to discuss and to discuss the film as well. He also has a great blog dedicated to 50s Westerns, which I highly, highly recommend if you're a 50s Western fan or someone who wants to get interested in Westerns. It's really, really great stuff. Toby, welcome back. I'm so glad you can talk about a Western with me today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. This is fun.
I really enjoyed this film because I know that when we last spoke, I had mentioned I haven't even really seen that many Westerns. You know, I've seen the odd classic, but some of the themes that you discussed really piqued my interest in terms of redemption or people that were haunted by the past, trying to make up for it in the present, and you know, discussing some different options for today. This is one that I always had heard about. I've always loved Sterling Hayden and, you know, Joan Crawford and the actors, and Nick Ray in A Lonely Place, Rebel Without a Cause. I thought, let me try this one. And I thought it was a really powerful film that was way ahead of its time. So I'm curious, how do you feel about this film, and have your feelings evolved or changed from seeing it, you know, when you were a kid to now?
Well, I love it. First of all, I love it. And I'm a big Nick Ray fan. So, you know, I've always admired his work, especially his use of color and CinemaScope and things like that. He's great with that. And of course, he's great with actors. But so this one wasn't in CinemaScope, but this is his second color film. And he does some really neat stuff with color. But as a kid, I was thinking that it was too long because they stand around and talk a lot.
Right.
Now, of course, I realize that that's a lot of that is kind of the point of the whole thing. One of the things that has strikes me about it now, and the thing I admire about it, is that with all that they were trying to do and say with it, that it really, in some ways, plays like a larger, more expensive B Western, because it touches on a lot of the things that Republic was known for. You know, you've got the sort of the basic B Western plot where you've got the guy that runs the town, in this case it's Ward Bond, and you know, the everybody's against everybody because this guy's trying to call in all the shots. He's got the marshal, who's played by the great Frank Ferguson, in his back pocket. And then you've got crazy things like from Republic serials, like the hideout that you get through the cave that has the waterfall in front of it, that everyone calls the lair, which always cracks me up. So it's funny, and it's almost in a way, I don't know if it was intentional or not, but it sort of either pokes fun at or pays homage to the studio that was footing the bill for it, which was Republic.
Yeah.
So, and it's got one of the best casts of any 50s Western. I mean, everybody who's anybody, from Royal Dano to Frank Ferguson to Paul Fix, they're all there. And they've all got great parts. So none of those character actors are just standing around this one. They all got great stuff to do. So yeah, there's a lot to admire about this one.
I totally agree. And, you know, it's interesting because my perception of Westerns has always been, you know, these guys who are, you know, people put this in many different ways. I look at it as sort of macho, or, you know, what today people maybe call like toxic masculinity, like just these guys who are man's men, you know, and are all about shooting and killing and fighting at the drop of a hat. And this film seems to be, in my opinion, it seems to be critical of that kind of behavior. It seemed that having like women leading these two packs, it seemed to be saying that's sort of not a good way to handle things, you know, right. That violence is really not the answer. And I was fascinated by the paranoia and the suspicions and the wariness that everyone has. And you see this murder off the top, the Emma Small, played by Mercedes McCambridge, her brother's been killed, and they all just assume that Joan Crawford as Vienna and the other gang, all this, you know, this with the John McIvers who played Warren Bond and Ernest Borgnine, this like gang that they don't know too much about, they just assume it must be them. But then you also get the impression they're just looking for a way to get rid of these people because of this railroad that they were building, where they were going to build a new town, and that was going to make a lot of money for Joan Crawford, and they would have to share the land, right? And these people do not want to do that. So I started to think, well, what is this fight really all about? No one knows what anyone did. And I love that comment towards the end that one of the guys says when it starts to get out of hand, you know what, I'm sick of this. This fight isn't even our fight. And I just thought, yeah, you guys are fighting over nothing. I mean, so I was curious if you saw these same sort of suspicions, wariness, paranoia as a major theme within the behavior of largely all the characters.
Right. Well, I think it's interesting that everybody seems to hate everybody else for all sorts of different reasons.
Yeah.
And all of that is sort of, you know, all of that seems to spin around Mercedes McCambridge. But there is a lot of paranoia. Mm. There's a lot of, you know, just, I mean, again, it's something that appears in those B Westerns where you've got it's either a cattleman or a banker or something that runs the town, and the sheriff is his toady, and they go around and they always, play havoc for the individual guy, you know, and that sort of the individual thing is a big deal with Ray. You know, you've got somebody who's sort of an outcast in society. Yes. And yeah. You watch them go through that. And so some of that, there's a little bit of paranoia in that as well. That sort of bleeds into this. And I think, Ray did that with everything, whether it's James Dean or Jesus in King of Kings.
That's a good point. Crawford.
And so that's one of the things I always admire about his movies is how I feel built like an outsider myself. So, you know, watching those characters go through their stuff on Dangerous Ground is a great one. And so that's another big part of it. And paranoia and all that stuff is a big part of it. One thing, this is my little weird little tangent thing. I went to high school in the 80s outside Philadelphia, Doylestown, Pennsylvania. And Mercedes McCambridge, you know, she had a problem with alcohol.
Right.
And she went around to schools and stuff lecturing about drinking.
Oh,
and that's interesting. I grew up in a movie nut house, and I was in high school. I was very much aware of Johnny Guitar.
Yeah.
And she, at the end of her talk, she had done the voice. She'd done the devil's voice for The Exorcist.
Yeah, which she's probably more known for.
And talked about that a lot.
Yeah.
But me, I sat there the whole time going, that's Emma Small. Yeah. Emma Small was at my high school. Emma Small says I shouldn't drink. I was just wanting her to just, you know, go off on a tirade like she does in this movie. But she was very cool. But I was starstruck by Emma Small.
That's incredible. Did you get to talk to her one-on-one at all? Okay, wow. Yeah, but still, to see her, that's amazing. Yeah,
there were a lot of people who were having, you know, real, you know, personal problems that we're talking to her.
Film buff. Oh my God, I need your autograph.
Oh my God, it's Emma Small. That would have really kind of screwed things up.
Yeah, no, I don't blame you. No, that's a great, you know, she's so, so good in this. And what's so fascinating about her character is I appreciate that you don't know the background of anyone really, because it makes it for a more enriching experience. I always like when I don't necessarily know what's happened to these people in their lives, because it makes it more ambiguous and it makes me think about it. And in her case, she's like rougher, and Joan Crawford's character, Vienna, to an extent as well. She's rougher than any of the guys. Yeah.
The meanest person in the whole movie.
Her idea to hang Joan Crawford as Vienna, also the young boy. You know, it's her, everything was her idea to go after these people that when the bank robbery happens, she's convinced Vienna's in on it. So, and she just, she's so good at infusing fear amongst everybody. And you wonder why. And there's that great moment where Joan Crawford says, well, she's afraid to be vulnerable. She's actually in love with the kid, one of the gang members. And I thought that was a real key to her character. And it wasn't really, it wasn't something that they went into. Right. But I like that they didn't, because again, it made her mysterious. And I'm curious, why do you think they had that part where Joan Crawford describes that she's afraid to be vulnerable?
Right. Well, you know, you touch on something that Nick Ray does. I think a lot of great movies do, especially older movies. They were better at this than movies today, I think. John Ford was great at this, is that they just tell you enough.
Yeah.
And you fill in the gaps yourself.
I love that.
You can look back on it and we know exactly what the dynamics were with those people, but they never stopped the movie to tell you what they were. We just figured it out. And it wasn't rocket science. It just, you got little bits and pieces to figure out that, you know, the dancing kid wanted Vienna and didn't want Emma Small. So Emma Small hated Vienna because of that. And
right.
Then you've got the money stuff and the railroad stuff and all things, but you know, that little basic thing, and they never really told us that. We
exactly.
just figured it out.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great thing about this movie, and because there's a lot of weird dynamics between all these characters, all their relationships and stuff. And so we just have to pick it up, and as it goes along, and it drops little things here and there,
yeah,
to clear them up. As the movie goes on, we learn more about those relationships. It's really well put together.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I also thought, because she's perhaps, again, there's two women in this, Joan Crawford and her, and Miss Mercedes McCambridge. So I wondered if perhaps because she's living amongst men, educated by men, as a way to be accepted by them, she had to behave like them, if not behave even more quote unquote macho, or however, like she basically has to be tougher and go further, because right. if she wasn't, she would have felt that she wasn't included, you know, that she wouldn't right. be accepted. I mean, she's has probably more in common with Vienna and the other outsiders than she does with her own crew. And
exactly. you know,
and I found that fascinating. And I think that's perhaps why she had to be more ruthless than anyone. And I also thought it was interesting that when you see her get shot towards the end, that the kid calls out her name and doesn't call out Vienna. So, which brought me back to that right. dance they have off the top, you know, with when yeah. Stillman Hayden's playing the guitar, and you can see that she's enjoying it. She's trying to hide it.
Right.
But then it makes me wonder, well, who did he really like? You know, because there's this love triangle right. with Hayden, Vienna, and the kid. And I mean, maybe something was between them, but you don't see
right.
it.
They hint at it, but you don't really know exactly yeah. how deep it went. One of the things I think is really interesting about it is that, you know, this was made during the McCarthy period. And,
that's right.
You know, so you've got someone like Mercedes McCambridge who... she just seems to hate Joan Crawford, if for no other reason, just because she's different.
Right.
You know, she's independent. She's doing her own thing. And so she just has to hate her. And so I think, you know, that and their paranoia comes from that, too. It was a very paranoid time.
That's
and
right.
So I think that sort of hints at that as well. A lot of movies. 54 was a really big year for McCarthy stuff creeping into movies.
Well, you know, what I find so fascinating, it certainly plays to the time, like you said, McCarthyism. But I mean, to this day, to me, it's almost a story of America, if not Canada as well, because Canada and America were very, very similar. And this fear of outsiders in general, I mean, we see that now more than ever. I mean,
oh yeah,
with how much people are saying terrible things about either refugees or immigrants. And I saw that in this film, and she even mentions Mercedes McCambridge when she's talking about the people coming in the railroad. If we let people come, oh, they're going to be, she's not talking about people outside of America, but like farmers or people that aren't decent or people that were in their view below them. Did you think, it's interesting that they called the film Johnny Guitar. I mean, he has a big part in it. What do you think the Qatar was some kind of metaphor for something?
You know, I've thought about that quite a bit. I don't know. It's just I think part of it is just it's an interesting title, but that was the title of the book.
Right.
And I have a copy of the book around here somewhere, but I haven't read it. I've been wanting to read it to kind of see exactly how much of the story came from the book and how much of it came from Philip Yordan and Nick Ray themselves. But I don't know, because Johnny Guitar is not even his real name. His real name is Johnny Logan. I don't know. But it's interesting that it's named after his fake name, because he, you know, was the notorious gunslinger and he's trying to live down that past.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's the name, the movie is named after his fake name. So, you know, I don't know.
I wondered if it had to do with, you know, because Vienna is someone who, this relationship that she had with Hayden, you know, of course, Hayden is back after 5 years, they split up. Right. And he's trying to win her back, and you get a strong suggestion that they broke up because she didn't like that he was, like, again, a quote unquote macho man, quick with the trigger. And you know, he comes back not with a gun but with a guitar. And again, what does a guitar bring? Music, right. Joy, love, happiness. So I saw it almost as you know, put down the guns and put up your instrument, as cheap, as corny as that may sound. That's, you know, I wonder if that's what it was about. That
a lot of the dialogue between Crawford and Hayden is, it's fairly representative, almost stereotypical love story movie dialogue.
Yeah.
But it's just flipped. So Hayden says the kind of lines you would expect a woman to say.
That's right.
And Crawford says the lines that you'd expect the man to say.
Yeah.
And that really is interesting. There was, I feel like there was definitely an effort to turn the Western on its ear.
Yeah.
You know, they played with so many of the conventions and they turned things upside down and sort of zigged where the audience would have expected them to zag as often as they could. And that, I think that's kind of, you know, I've learned the hard way about recommending 50s Westerns to people who aren't, you know, really trying to dig into them. And this is one that I would recommend to people quite a bit. And some people would really love it. And some people would come back the next day and go, what in the hell did you get me to make me watch? Yeah, it's interesting. Some people really grew. Other people, it just doesn't make any sense.
Do you think it's because they expect it to be like a man's genre? This is very much like from a woman's point of view. Yeah, that's what I imagine.
And I, you know, it's people who aren't necessarily Western, you know, Western fans who, you know, I can see expecting a Western to be this way.
Right.
But this was just, here's a really neat movie, and they're expecting it to, you know, it's just not what they, in any way, what they expected.
Because at the time, it did pretty well at the box office, but a lot of the reviews were, I think it just drew people. It was, I'm sure you know this, they just thought, you know, how can this is, one of the reviews I read was that this is feminism gone too far. But you see that later on, it was the Cahiers, the guys in the French New Wave starting to say, This is actually a great film. And I read even in the 70s, apparently, you know, in the feminist movement, a lot of women were talking about this film, because it certainly is ultimately, you know, women who are much more capable, we see, and much more, not what we saw in a lot of, from what I've read, other Western female representations, the women were much more just, you know, vulnerable, trying to just, you know, be there for the man, and weren't, you know, capable of, or weren't as capable in the story to do much more than that. I mean, is that generally true of maybe before 54? I know that there were some.
Right. Women's parts in Westerns across the board haven't been very good. You know, usually it's somebody to be rescued, or, you know, somebody to kiss before the end credit comes up. And so I think it's really, and while that's unfortunate, it does, when you get a Western where it's got a really strong part for the actress, it really stands out. And of course, this one's tailor-made for Joan Crawford. I mean, it's perfect for her.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was reading about some of the making of this, and apparently it was, you know, Joan Crawford was a nightmare for most. And, you know, we've heard of those reports on other films, like Nick Ray saying that he threw up before going there every day just because he was so nervous. And Sterling Hayden said he would never work with her again, and he had to fight with her all day and then his second wife at night. Did you read anything on this that interested you, the making of this one?
Yeah, there's a lot about this one. Well, first of all, Crawford left. She quit the movie for a while. Oh. I think my take on it is she hated Mercedes McCambridge.
Right, and, yeah, there was a huge feud. Tore up her clothes.
Yeah, that was really bad. They hated each other.
Yeah.
And I think it was after they shot Mercedes McCambridge's big scene where she has the big speech before they try to hang them. I think Crawford saw she was about to get upstaged and she had a temper tantrum.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's a really powerful scene. That's
a great scene.
In a lot of ways, the movie sort of hinges around that scene because that's when everything, you know, goes off the rails. But
yeah,
there's a neat thing about it that they shot it, you know, in Sedona. Republic had been shooting movies there for a while. They had for the cheaper movies, they would just send some doubles and a small crew and just shoot riding scenes and splice it in, you know, later and take advantage of all that gorgeous scenery. But that color palette in the movie is really great because you've got all those red rocks that from that area and they're beautiful. I think you can see Coffee Pot Rock a few times in the background. But the fact that that Vienna's saloon is built into the side of the mountain, so you can see the back wall, like when she's sitting there playing piano, the wall behind her is rock, is that red Sedona rock.
Right.
Why, I don't know, but it's cool.
Yeah.
So that's pretty neat. So they did some neat stuff with that. And the footage of the saloon burning down at the end, that became stock footage that turned up a lot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they've seen that a lot over the years. I think it was in like a lot of TV shows and stuff. There's something in it that I have always thought was really cool is that they have the funeral they don't show you the funeral, but a bunch of the cast goes to this funeral for Emma Small's brother who's killed at the beginning. And so the rest of the movie, all of them are dressed in black.
Yes.
Ward Bond, everybody's dressed in black, all of them in black suits and Mercedes McCambridge in a black dress. And at that moment is when Joan Crawford puts on a white dress.
Oh, yeah.
So you've got the
black and white, good and evil.
This is a movie where the bad guys are the members of the community, right? The upstanding community are the bad guys. And so we dress them in black. And the woman with the maybe a little bit kind of a shifty past runs a saloon, she's our good guy, and she's dressed in white. And I thought that was really an interesting little thing to do. And so for most of the rest of the movie, that's the way they're dressed. So
that's we got a dog in here. You gotta have a dog when you do a Western review. Or a horse or something in the background.
There's lots of shots looking down from the very beginning when Hayden rides into town. He's up on that hill looking down and he can see, he sees the stagecoach hold up below him. And then in the big scene, the opening scene in the saloon, Joan Crawford is standing up on that balcony kind of thing, looking down at everybody. So lots of the shots are looking down.
Yeah.
And that goes on throughout the movie is that people looking down. And at one point, Mercedes McCambridge just says to her that she's staring down on us like she was somebody.
The emotion, I suppose, of the POV of looking down on others is what I imagine he was doing with those.
And you know, Peggy Lee's song, you know, that was pretty popular song. It only appears at the very end.
Right at the end, yeah.
And it's not, you know, it's nowhere near the whole thing. But that song is, you know, it's still out there.
I also really liked Hayden. Like I said, I love Hayden. And I was just recently saw that. I don't know if you saw that documentary on him from the early 80s. Pharaoh.
I have not.
Oh, it's great. Pieces
of it. Yeah, I'm a big Hayden fan.
Yeah, it's sad because it's, you know, he basically, you know, just drank and he was living in a boat out in Marseille. I mean, it's quite fascinating, but a lot of the fact that he named names during the McCarthyism really destroyed him. And this was a film that he put down pretty much everything he did after the 50s, because when his career was really on the up and up, but I think he felt that he didn't deserve it because of what he did. So he learned, it's a little like Brando, you know, not that Brando named names, but just sort of turned on his success over various reasons. And in his case, I think the guilt of succeeding by naming names sort of destroyed him, but he was
he wrote a great book called Wanderer.
Yeah, I gotta read that. I didn't know he wrote any
books.
It's
really cool. He took his kids. His marriage was in bad shape, and he took his kids and he sailed around the world with them. Quit making, you know, and then I think the first movie he made when he came back was Dr. Strangelove, I believe.
That's right.
And so you know, he was great. He's great.
Yeah.
He made a lot of cheap little movies, but I love a lot of them.
It's a wonderful film. So I got to thank you again for suggesting it and taking the time to come on and discuss this classic. So yeah, I'd love to have you back because I'm certainly going to be looking at more Western. So thank you, and please come again.
Absolutely. You just holler and we'll do it.
All right. Fantastic. And the website is 50swesterns.wordpress.com, right? For your
.com, and 50s is spelled out. So 50swesterns.com.
50swesterns.com.
I'm not going to put a date on when the book is going to be done. It just will be done.
Okay, great. No, I'm looking forward to
there's a chapter on Johnny Guitar.
Fantastic. And anyone who's a fan of One Eye Jack's, the book, behind me here is A Million Feet of Film, The Making of One Eye Jack's, Marlon Brando's Western that he also starred in. Is a fascinating book at sort of how Brando really tried to make this into a work of art and how it was taken away from him. And I think largely it's why he turned on Hollywood in a lot of ways. So if you're a Brando fan, Western fan, classic Hollywood fan, this is a real treat. So thanks again. And for those of you watching on YouTube, there is also an audio podcast version of this podcast. It's available on all of the platforms where you can listen to audio podcasts anywhere. Not all the episodes that are on YouTube are on the audio version. So head over to YouTube if you want to hear or watch more. And if this is your first time here, please consider subscribing by pressing the Robert Bellissimo at the Movies logo. You'll see it floating above my head right here to your top left. Just click on that and then click the bell in order to get a notification every time I release a new video or when I go live. Thank you again, Toby, and thanks everyone.
Thank you.
We'll see everyone in the next episode.